Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Restaurants around the country are standing on unstable ground.
There's a little bit of the soul of downtown San Diego, Little Italy, that's different now.
We can't reemploy people for enough hours in that it will hurt them to leave unemployment.
I'm currently three payrolls behind.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, May 19th, how restaurants are faring during the pandemic. Then, with East Africa facing three crises at once, we take a trip to Ethiopia and talk about its leadership.
It helps to have a Nobel Peace Prize laureate as prime minister because, you know, nobody would ignore your calls.
Also, who and what is represented in photos and video of the pandemic?
We don't necessarily need to see images of the dying, but what we do need are a set of images that will allow us to arrive at that iconic picture.
Let's get started. In some parts of the country, dine-in food service is back on the menu. Restaurants in states including Florida and Texas are now allowed to operate at 25% occupancy. Some restaurants are enforcing temperature checks for staff and customers. Meanwhile, many businesses are just doing takeout and delivery for now. But initial shutdowns, combined with the ongoing shifts in how restaurants do business, are resulting in massive losses for the industry. More than 8 million restaurant employees have been laid off or furloughed because of COVID-19, according to the National Restaurant Association. The industry has lost tens of billions in revenue, making only roughly $32 billion in April. That's less than half of what they've been bringing in just 2 months before. If you own a restaurant or other food service business, how has the coronavirus affected you so far?
Hi, my name's Mark from San Juan Capistrano, California. I am an investor in a San Diego restaurant that was doing great. I mean, top reviews, always crowded, a very positive social scene. In just a few short years of its existence, the place really transcended into a neighborhood cultural center point. And it also employed scores of excellent service workers. And now, not much going on there, some takeout, but more than that, there's a little bit of the soul of downtown San Diego, Little Italy, that's different now. It's very sad.
We own a coffee house on Long Island, and fortunately, it's very scalable to the situation. However, right now, we are in the position where we have enough business and need labor, but we can't re-employ people for enough hours in that it will hurt them to leave unemployment.
Michal O'Leary calling from Nashville, Tennessee. I moved here last year to open an Irish pub. With the tornado and the coronavirus following, it has become an absolute rough time for all involved. Other than the emergency $10,000 that was given by the SBA, we've really received no help from the government. And $10,000 is just enough for one payroll. And I'm currently three payrolls behind.
Restaurant owners, you can keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. On Monday, restaurant industry leaders met with President Trump to discuss how the pandemic has affected businesses. Some of that conversation touched on ways the Paycheck Protection Program could be adjusted to assist restaurants struggling due to COVID-19. And we should mention, in full disclosure, New York Public Radio, the parent organization of WNYC, which produces this show, is a recipient of a PPP loan from the Small Business Administration. But without any guarantees from Congress on changes to assistance to restaurants and the reluctance from many customers to return to old dining habits, the financial future of the industry is shaky at best. Besides, ongoing health concerns raised by the pandemic have the potential to permanently alter the restaurant experience. Here with me now to discuss all of this is Hillary Dixler-Canavan, restaurant editor of Eater. Thanks for being here, Hillary.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Marcos Carbajal, co-owner of Carnitas Uruapan, which has two locations in Chicago. Great to have you with us, Marcos.
Thank you for having us. Excited to be here.
So Hillary, let's start with you. Tell us about the PPP loan. How helpful or unhelpful has PPP been for most small independent restaurants?
Yeah, the helpfulness of PPP is really a case-by-case issue. I've spoken to restaurant owners who were able to secure a PPP loan and have used it effectively. One example that comes to mind is a restaurant in Cape Cod where the staff was really, really small to begin with. This was a chef owner, and she had only working pre-pandemic two cooks, a dishwasher, a porter, and a front of house staffer. So when she decided that she was going to pivot from doing a tasting menu to doing takeaway and more grab and go casual restaurant when she reopens, she found that she could fully rehire her staff, meeting the provisions of the PPP forgiveness clause, which is that you have to rehire to pre-pandemic levels by June 30th. She found that she was able to meet it and that that money was really helpful to get people back on payroll. But for many, many restaurants, those parameters, rehiring full staff by June 30th, 75% of the loan has to go towards payroll. They found that that just simply wasn't enough to sustain their financial needs in the present. And also, they suspect that come June 30th, they won't have need for full staff, given mandates around reduced capacity. So there's a real concern that you would rehire people and then have to lay them off again when your business can't sustain the payroll.
Now, Marcos, you, from what I understand, applied for a PPP loan but have not received one. What has COVID-19 meant for your restaurants financially?
Financially, it's been an immense strain. It's just been one of those, you know, black swan type of events that you really could never see coming. You know, I opened a new location a little over a year ago after an established, you know, location that my father started that's been in the community for 45 years here in Chicago. You know, had a great first year. Everything was going fantastic. Their new location was, I'd say, selling just as much consistently as the existing 45-year-old location, just a year in. So things were going great. And then, you know, this event happened and I had modeled about a 30% drop, you know, in my forecasting, just to kind of stress test our business and figured out, you know, worst case scenario or recession hits, 30% drop in business, which is huge. That first week during the lockdown, we lost 60% of our business overnight.
Wow. I imagine you've had to lay off or furlough workers.
So we've been incredibly fortunate in that sense. We have not had to do any significant layoffs. We probably have 95% of our staff. The few people that we did have to let go were, you know, kids in high school, dishwashers, you know, bussers. And ironically enough, it's people whose parents worked in the restaurant. So I was able to at least have some kind of revenue stream going to that family. But we have, you know, cut hours in half effectively. So we have just about everyone still working, but it's not on a meaningful basis to sustain them for the long term.
Hillary, how do most restaurants operate financially in normal times? And then what sort of additional strains have those old standards of doing business put on them during this moment?
So if you're thinking about the smaller independent restaurants, it's sort of a cliche to use this phrasing, but restaurants are said to operate on razor thin margins. And what that really means is if you think about a neighborhood restaurant in a big American city, they're dealing with some really high fixed cost. Probably the highest among those costs is rent. And then another high cost is labor, even though some of that labor cost in America is typically shifted onto the consumer who pays tips. And then they've got their sort of changing costs, which is like their cost of food. And the way restaurants make money is they sell food and drink at a markup. And those sales create profits that go towards paying off the fixed cost. And, you know, whatever is left on top, that's your profit margin. And when I say razor thin, I mean razor, razor thin. So there are restaurants for whom a bad week or two can really throw things off. You know, restaurants close at a pretty speedy clip, regardless of what's happening in the news cycle. It's a tough business. So something like when the pandemic hit, restaurants were already down when customers were choosing to social distance, even prior to mandates that restricted them to takeout and delivery. And yeah. I would say, in terms of the impact of the pandemic, restaurants have been able to cut some of their costs by perhaps letting people go, reducing their payroll. You know, if you're serving less food, you're buying less food. But the real question mark for a restaurant's survival often right now is hinging on rent. Can they afford to pay their rent? Or is the act of paying rent just bankrupting the business?
Marcos, you had said that you cut hours by about half. How have you been able to keep the restaurants open in terms of just dealing with the safety of your workers and then customers? What kind of changes have you put in place?
In terms of safety, we've had to completely rethink our model. On the inside, internally with our team, everyone has temperature checks in the morning when they come in. There's a mandatory mask policy. Everyone is wearing gloves when in contact with food. Essentially, you know, about, I'd say probably twice an hour, everybody's washing their hands. We're being very, very vigilant, you know, not just for the benefit of our customers, but really for ourselves. I think, you know, the biggest threat to restaurants right now is on the inside. It's people working together in, you know, small confined spaces, sharing a bathroom, you know, really not being able to social distance properly on the job. That's, you know, the way these kitchens are designed. You know, people work next to each other in tight spaces, especially in big cities. You know, there's not a lot of real estate to go around. So you've really got to make do with it. And when restaurants are designed, you know, they're designed to have the smallest bathroom possible, the smallest kitchen possible to try to maximize dining space. And that's completely turned everything on its head now. In terms of our, you know, customers, we've actually gone further than what the city of Chicago required. The requirement was not to have consumption on premises, so people could come into the restaurant. We frequently have 40, 50, sometimes 60 people waiting in line to buy our carnitas on a Saturday and Sunday morning. There's basically always a line. So now that line is outside the restaurant. No one's coming in.
And socially distanced outside, I imagine.
They are. It took a little bit to get people used to that, but we put markers out there. We rode on the sidewalk. We really, you know, would have to continuously go out there, especially in the early days. Now, you know, people are just, you know, they're very informed and they're scared and they're compliant.
Marcos, what policies do you think would be most helpful to your restaurants in the short term?
In the short term, I think something that, you know, doesn't have to be applied for, that's just immediately received, you know, that has impact on a broad level. One thing that's immensely helped us is the fact that the SBA is paying SBA debt for 6 months. Our new restaurant, which we opened a year ago, was funded by an SBA 504 loan. That loan is now covered fully for 6 months, which essentially gives us, you know, 6 months of runway. Aside from that, I think perhaps looking at a reduction or an elimination of payroll tax across the board for a period of time, you know, without the need to, you know, get in a queue that is essentially endless for many people who will never get to the front of the line. I think, you know, that something along those lines would be extremely beneficial, or a tax credit, even though that still might not solve the liquidity issue.
Marcos Carbajal is the co-owner of Carnitas Uruapan in Chicago, and Hillary Dixler Canavan is restaurant editor of Eater. Thanks so much to you both, and best of luck to you, Marcos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
News of death is inescapable during this pandemic. Each day, we're confronted by numbers, facts, graphs, reminding us of COVID-19's toll around the world. But the photos and videos we see or don't see point to the kind of death we're comfortable publishing, especially in the U.S. news media. For more on this, we're joined by two people who have been thinking a lot about visual representations of this pandemic. Sarah Elizabeth Lewis is an associate professor of history of art and architecture and African and African American studies at Harvard University. And Patrick Gathara is a journalist and political cartoonist based in Nairobi, Kenya. According to Sarah, the story of the pandemic is being told visually in three main ways.
In the United States, we have images of the president speaking in his daily briefings. We have images of the COVID as an icon, an object. And we have images of essential and frontline workers. But what struck me is that we don't have images of what is very hard to depict, but the human cost and the suffering that's happening. It was striking to me as I considered it, largely because one of my dear mentors and friends died early on in this crisis, Maurice Berger, who's thought so deeply about the function of images in moments of crisis and justice. And the conversations I would have been having with him would have centered around the very images that we're not being given at this moment.
What are those images that you imagine that we're not seeing?
When you think back in different moments over history, whether it's the Civil War or the Great Depression or moments in the civil rights movement, we have images that become emblems of sacrifice and human cost. Now, what we're not seeing, and it's difficult really to even visualize, but are those who have died of COVID, who are dying of COVID, whose own sacrifice really does become a way to understand the gravitas of the moment. There are reasons for that, and there are good reasons for that. HIPAA laws, medical privacy laws, of course, give us a way to honor the dignity of the dying and the dead. On the other hand, there are ways to convey this sacrifice.
I wonder what the ways are to convey the sacrifice. I mean, are you speaking of the idea of just seeing more dead bodies?
No, it's not that simple. You know, I wrote a piece for the New York Times and they titled it, "Where Are the Photos of People Dying of COVID?" And as the author, you're not privy to your own title necessarily before it comes out. And when I first saw that, I was actually shocked myself. It is, I think, an apt title. But really, the argument I was making in writing the piece was that we don't necessarily need to see images of the dying. But what we do need are a set of images that constitute a kind of collective archive that will allow us to arrive at that iconic picture. Think Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother, for example, or works by Gordon Parks during the Civil Rights Movement. Without the images that show the full extent of this catastrophe, we might not arrive at that emblem and will then be forced to still have only statistics and data, which really over time, history shows us, is not the way that we've moved masses to act.
Why do you think the news media has largely refrained from showing more graphic images?
Well, there are two reasons. One is to do with medical privacy laws, and that's really, really straightforward, and I'm not arguing against that. That's as it should be. But the second reason complicates it. We do have cultural norms in the United States that are different from other nations that have prevented us from showing images not of the gruesome sort of death toll counts of different crises, but even of images of coffins themselves, of, say, soldiers coming back from war. Think about the shift that happened in the 19 years between the first Bush administration's decision after the Persian Gulf War to not show images of returning soldiers in coffins. And fast forward to 2009, when the Obama administration permitted this to happen. We saw in that moment that the decision was a cultural one. The policy change was a cultural one. Many have asked, well, why that changed? In part, images became politicized after the Vietnam War when the human cost of the conflict galvanized the opposition to war. So from that moment onward, you've seen this cultural development and shifting of norms around how it is that we represent the dead and the dying in American life.
Patrick, you recently wrote about the Western news media's pandemic coverage for Al Jazeera and specifically how it compares to that of the Ebola epidemic. How do images of this pandemic compare with those from other infectious disease outbreaks elsewhere?
There were lots of images that were published by Western news media of dead bodies. When you compare it with the coverage of the COVID-19 crisis, there's pretty much nothing in that sense. In fact, I believe 2014 or 2015, a New York Times photographer won the Pulitzer Prize for essentially his photographs following around a team of people collecting bodies, taking pictures of some pretty gruesome and pretty heart-wrenching scenes. Now, you don't see much of this with regard to coronavirus, and part of it is because of where it's happening. You know, and I'm here speaking specifically about the Western media's coverage.
Do you think that the imagery of the coronavirus would look different if the epicenter was, let's say, in Africa and not all across the world, and if there was not this outbreak in the United States?
I definitely think that it would look different if it was the epicenter was in Africa. I don't think it's a racist thing. I know many people tend to portray it in those terms, but I think that it's mostly because of the cultural sensitivities. If you think about how journalism works across the world, newspapers and even broadcast media tend to show very little actual death, you know, sort of gruesome death. And they even show less when the death is closer to them. So in Kenya's case, when we have incidents that happen here in Kenya, whether it's a terrorist attack or whatever, you'll never find pictures of bodies. Or it will be very rare that they'll be showing pictures of bodies from those incidents. So I think it's a global sort of approach to telling the news where images that are of incidents that are closer to you are seen as more disturbing to your audience.
Do media organizations face some risks in showing such images, Patrick?
There is definitely a risk of blowback. I mean, if you think, for example, in the case of the U.S., after the 9/11 attacks, you had the picture of the falling man, somebody who had jumped off, leapt off one of the burning things. And it caused lots of blowback once it was published. And I think that's one thing that editors obviously fear. The same thing happens here in Kenya is the editors were quite clear that they are afraid of alienating audiences, you know, and if you publish something that is seen to be offensive, then you run the risk of people simply not coming back, not buying your newspaper the next day.
How do the visuals we're seeing in the media shape our understanding of any situation at hand? What kind of messages do these visuals send?
There is a way in which we are able to comprehend a crisis through a humanizing image that outstrips the power of numbers alone, right? So we have this inverse relationship between high numbers and comprehension. So it's harder to picture tragedy, right, of the kind we're witnessing now than it is just to visualize one person in pain, which is what freights this conversation, I think, with such importance. It's not just about access and respect for the dead. There is a way in which the composition of the image itself, the use of lighting, can convey a level of respect that allows for an image to perhaps be more palatable to an audience, that might lower the risk regarding blowback, but that presents to the world what is actually happening and what they need to see.
And Sarah, should those pictures be, is there a role to create empathy or urgency in a time like this?
In the history of photography, the question about how pictures generate empathy is central. This is a conversation that's happened throughout scholarship between, you know, Susan Sontag, who initially in On Photography argued that images can actually blunt our ability to be sensitized to violence. It can paralyze us. She once argued, and she changed her position on that. Other scholars have come in, Susie Linfield, for example, and made different arguments there. I'm of the belief, though, that images are still vital. The question for me is not so much about scale, how many images are required to potentially move people to act, but about scope, you know, what type of image, what kind of composition, what image might become our emblem. And we'll never arrive at that without seeing more than we are right now.
You mentioned some of those emblems historically earlier. I think of Emmett Till, martyr of the civil rights movement, whose open casket was photographed at his funeral. Are there other photographs that we will all recall that serve as such an emblem?
You've really identified, I think, the central one. If there was any image that was left out of the New York Times piece that I initially put in, it was precisely that one. I think what's also important to note and to add to the conversation is that we are more accustomed to seeing images of Black death and suffering in the United States. Now, there's a long history of surveillance embedded in slavery that has conditioned us, I believe, to accept that. And that's a nuance here that, to me, is a kind of dark night of the soul question regarding COVID. That is to say, if we actually saw images of the demographics of those who were among the dead and the dying, given the racial disparities here, how might that impact our level of empathy? That, to me, is a difficult question to address.
Patrick, do you have anything to add about that in terms of the types of bodies that we're comfortable showing compared to others? You spoke about proximity, and those closer to home are less likely to get those images of those who die closer to home. Are there other considerations, and are there other factors?
The scale of the incident at hand, or the event at hand, also matters. So, for example, in Kenya, you find our editors will use images for their shock value. So where they feel they need to communicate the gravity of what has happened, then they'd be more inclined to show an image that might be disturbing. You know, obviously they do this, they take great care to try and minimize the trauma they might cause an audience. So they'll do stuff like take the image from a distance or show a body while blurring out the face. One thing I would say is that it's not the case that it's wrong to show graphic images. They've got their place. I think there are stories that essentially call for the use of that. I actually believe that even in the case of the coverage of COVID, that the absence of images of death might be leading people to be a bit more complacent about this, you know, when all they're seeing is simply graphs or being given statistics and is not really bringing home the reality of death, you know, that's not in their everyday coverage, then I think people will tend to be complacent.
Sarah, I'm wondering if you had any recommendations for media organizations. I mean, part of this challenge, you know, I'm a reporter, I've worked with photographers for many years. Part of the challenge, I imagine, is logistic. They can't get inside the nursing home to be there when the person dies. They are not allowed into the funeral home before a person is cremated. Do you have any recommendations for how news organizations could approach this by visually telling this story?
I think first is to allow us to feel the humanity of this crisis by featuring the stories of the family members who have lost loved ones. I'm struck by the fact that we have not had a sense of national and collective mourning come from our national leadership. That, I think, can be rectified by those personal stories, and the main platform we have for them are our news media outlets. I think the second recommendation I'd have, and I've been struck by the various kind of tech companies that have reached out to me after publishing the New York Times piece, is just to consider how can we craft an archive, not necessarily of images taken just on the front lines, but of the photographers who still are working in isolation, crafting images of what it looks like to take the guidelines seriously, how life has changed as a result of it. Again, it's not the emblem necessarily of the gruesome tale that needs to be shown, but the scope in its entirety that we need to see.
Patrick, do you have any recommendations for how news organizations can better report on this pandemic visually?
First is when inevitably or eventually that the epicenter moves and we see more deaths in places like Africa, I think editors have to start thinking now, how are they going to cover that? The second recommendation I'd make would be to use more local expertise, more local photographers, more local journalists in that coverage, because they come to it with nuance. They come to it with sensitivity.
Patrick Athara is a journalist and political cartoonist based in Nairobi, Kenya, and Sarah Elizabeth Lewis is an associate professor of history of art and architecture and African and African American studies at Harvard University. Sarah, Patrick, thank you so much for the thoughtful conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the furor on college campuses over the war in Gaza.
Students have tried to have dialogue over and negotiate differences in how they see the world, even as they respond to tragedies and crimes overseas.
Students and faculty from Harvard University on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on the show, we're visiting a different part of the world each day to see how it's managing the COVID-19 pandemic. Yesterday, we took you to Sweden. Today, we go to East Africa, where a trifecta of crises is endangering people and raising fears of a mass famine. Along with the coronavirus, the region is dealing with flooding, as well as swarms of billions of desert locusts, harming food production and causing fears of widespread famine. And as you can imagine, with the three crises combined, countries in the region are less equipped than usual to manage any of these problems. I asked Samuel Getachew, local journalist in Ethiopia with The Reporter, about all of this, including how locusts have affected food production in the region so far.
They've literally destroyed it, and Ethiopia doesn't have the equipment to even prevent it from spreading all over the country and in neighboring countries as well. You know, the UN has donated helicopters and so on, but the impact is so large and so huge that Ethiopia is asked for help from outside countries because it can no longer afford to protect the land that has been destroyed.
Is that help forthcoming?
Many countries have are beginning to make a donation to the cause. The UN has managed to raise 70% of the money that's needed to prevent the spread of locusts. But Ethiopia remains to be a country that's in need of support. And the help, you know, the call for help is louder than ever because more people are expected to be suffering because of shortage of food.
This is terrible timing amid a global pandemic. What does East Africa look like right now in terms of COVID-19?
You know, the government gives you official numbers, but it's just like in the U.S., you know, whenever the president tells you numbers, you hardly believe the numbers anymore because deep down we know that the numbers are much, much higher than that are given to the public. You know, Ethiopia is a population of 110 million people, but the government is claiming to only have 350 positive cases out of 110 million people. So, you know, sometimes the numbers are sugar-coated, and we know that deep down, we know the number is much, much higher than.
Right. Sounds familiar. So what is the Ethiopian government doing? What are they saying they're doing in terms of responding to the crisis?
They're doing the usual thing, which is, you know, preventing people from going outside at night. They're closing clubs and restaurants and pubs after 7 p.m. You know, the buses are not crowded anymore because they could only carry so many people. The taxis are only allowed to take few passengers. The police are on the lookout for people that refuse to wear masks. I think they're trying to do the best from what they have. But, you know, and at least in my generation, we've never had this kind of case, not just in Ethiopia, but in the world. So we were learning from the best. We're learning from the U.S., the experiences of the U.S., the London and the Rome and the European nations. But I don't think we have the kinds of numbers we're seeing in the U.S. or in the U.K. At least it's not visible to us.
Are there enough medical resources to handle the pandemic if the numbers increase to a great extent?
Definitely not. The Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke to the President, Donald Trump, on the phone, and the U.S. has pledged to donate, to give, not just to Ethiopia. According to the President's Twitter account, he's been having phone calls to many, many African countries. But the kind of resources Ethiopia has is hardly enough to even serve the capital city, which I reside in. The Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, so he's on a political honeymoon. Many, many countries have listened to him. They're fascinated by his story. He's like the Justin Trudeau of the moment. So he, you know, many, many countries have a place to support his cause, which is the Ethiopian cause.
You mentioned that leadership has been referencing the fact that they've been in communication with the United States and President Trump. Is the international community backing up those words with dollars and funds to assist Ethiopia and other countries in the region right now?
I think so. You know, whenever the U.S. is missing at the table, you know, there's the Scandinavian countries that are coming up with resources and so on. Canada, the Prime Minister of Canada was just in town in February. And, you know, Ethiopia has lots of partners and friends in many, many countries. It helps to have a Nobel Peace Prize laureate as prime minister because, you know, nobody would ignore your calls. That's the benefit of, I think, winning the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, many people are coming on board and trying to help Ethiopia move forward and become more self-sufficient.
Has there been any change in terms of U.S. funding for Ethiopia under the Trump administration? And is it going one direction or another direction?
Slowly. You know, the funding formula that was promoted by the President Trump, hasn't had impact in Ethiopia yet. You know, if he was to be reelected in November, that's when Ethiopia will begin to really feel the legacy of Trump, which is a government that's anti-aid and more, you know, the U.S. interest focused. But so far, USAID is one of the biggest development partners in Ethiopia, and they've been doing fantastic work in all over the country. They're never perfect, but I think they're the ideal U.S. policy that is implemented in Ethiopia.
And the prime minister gets his phone calls answered by the president, and that's probably something that is greatly valued, I imagine.
Maybe he wants to get some wisdom from the prime minister of Ethiopia so he could perhaps win the Nobel Peace Prize next year.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll see what happens. if he does, we'll have you back on to talk about it. That would be interesting.
For sure.
Samuel Getachew is a local journalist in Ethiopia with The Reporter. Samuel, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you.
In immigration jails throughout the country, more than 1,000 immigrant detainees have tested positive for the coronavirus, of just 2,000 tests administered. 2 weeks ago, the first person in ICE custody died in California. As the positive coronavirus cases continue to climb among the 27,000 people held in county jails and private prisons on immigration violations, advocates and attorneys are demanding all ICE detainees be freed from these facilities, citing unhealthy and crowded conditions. At the Elizabeth Contract Detention Center in New Jersey, so far 18 immigrants have tested positive for COVID-19, and one corrections officer employed by the company CoreCivic, which runs the jail, died last week. A new lawsuit is demanding the release of the 114 people detained there. And over the weekend, healthcare workers organized a 24-hour vigil and protest at the facility, pushing for detained immigrants to be freed. Marie DeLuca was at that vigil. Marie is an emergency medicine doctor and an organizer with Doctors for Camp Closure. She joins us now to discuss what she has heard about conditions in ICE detention and about her activism. Marie, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marie, you're a doctor working on the front lines, fighting this pandemic in emergency rooms in New York City. Given how much you're dealing with already, what prompted you to spend 24 hours protesting at an ICE facility?
As you say, there have been a lot of cases of COVID-19 in detention. I have been working in New York City. I work in the emergency department. And in the last several months, I've taken care of hundreds of people with COVID-19. I've taken care of families who came in where I would treat one family member, and a few hours later, another person would come in from that family who had to be placed on a ventilator. This was one of the most difficult periods of time for me as a physician. And knowing that there are people who are in immigration detention and are contracting COVID-19 and are unable to socially distance and unable to access proper hygiene materials like soap, I'm very, very concerned. So we decided to hold this vigil, and actually several vigils across the country, to draw attention to our concerns, to draw attention to the conditions inside these detention facilities, and to demand that people be released for the safety of those inside and for the safety of all the communities surrounding the detention facilities.
I've been reporting on conditions inside ICE facilities, and I've seen that the guards, the corrections officers, are the ones that appear to get sicker at a higher rate than the detainees. So that seems to back up what you're saying.
Yes, I mean, any situation where there are people in close quarters together is going to put all of those people at risk of contracting this virus. And we're seeing that about 50% of the people that ICE has tested who are in their detention facilities have COVID-19. That's a very high rate. That's deeply concerning. And that's just among people who they've tested. We know that they've reported 18 cases in the Elizabeth Detention Center, but we also know that COVID-19 occurs in people who don't have symptoms, that not everyone who has symptoms gets tested. So we're concerned that that number is actually a significant underestimate of the number of people who are ill there.
So all of this is why you went to the Elizabeth Detention Center in New Jersey over the weekend and held this vigil. What was that like? What was it like doing this form of protest, given everything that's going on with the pandemic and then given social distancing rules?
In terms of social distancing rules, we made sure to have a small group of people present and maintain a 6-foot distance between all of us at all times. Everyone wore masks. We were very conscious of safety for this vigil. In terms of the experience for people participating, I think this was a very meaningful and very difficult experience for those who were at the vigil. Certainly, staying up for 24 hours is something that medical professionals do for their work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at some point in their training or during their work, doctors often do 24-hour shifts. I know I did 24-hour shifts when I was in training. That was part of the motivation for picking this style of demonstration or protest. It was a space that was filled with a lot of grief and a lot of sadness. We had a chance to speak with someone who was detained in the Elizabeth Detention Center and hear that person's words, hear about that person's experiences inside, their fear, their uncertainty. But also we heard about their hope, knowing that there were people who are advocating for them. We connected and collaborated with First Friends New Jersey and New York for this vigil. And they have been doing really incredible work to connect with people in the detention facility, to provide those people with support, to connect with their families. And that work is something that's incredibly meaningful and incredibly important, especially for people who are in detention, who often don't have a lot of chances to advocate for themselves.
Marie, tell us about your day-to-day work as a doctor. What have you been doing during the COVID-19 crisis?
During the crisis, I've been taking care of patients. The conditions in the emergency departments in New York City have improved over the last couple of weeks, largely, I think, as a result of the social distancing that all of us living in New York City have been practicing. Before that happened, it was very difficult. We had situations where it was very difficult to care for all the people who had come into the emergency department because there were more people than we had ever seen in that emergency department. I work in two hospitals, and there was a tremendous mobilization of resources and effort and energy by everybody who works in those facilities. But even with that mobilization, this was a very, very difficult time.
I can imagine. I'm just curious how you've been balancing all of that work, which must take a tremendous physical and emotional toll, with your activism.
I think that one of the things that a lot of us realize as healthcare workers is that our jobs extend beyond the walls of the hospital. And in an emergency department, I see often the end result of many social inequalities, many forces that go beyond heart attacks and strokes, and really extend out into how we provide care to people throughout their lives. So, for example, when I was training in emergency medicine, I trained in Detroit, and I took care of many patients who had never had access to a primary care doctor. As a result, I saw people who had developed kidney failure from high blood pressure at a very young age. I saw people having strokes from uncontrolled high blood pressure, again, at a very young age. And when you see that over and over again, it becomes impossible to ignore what's happening outside of the emergency department. And that motivates us to take action.
You said us. Have you seen a growing trend of healthcare workers becoming involved in activism like this? Not just with immigration detention issues, but maybe other issues as well?
Absolutely. There's a long history of healthcare workers being involved in public health advocacy, but especially in, you know, the last couple of years, I think we have seen an increase in people taking a stand and being willing to put themselves out there to advocate. I personally have found that over the last several months since we started Doctors for Camp Closure, I've met many doctors and healthcare workers who are very dedicated to the cause of public health and are willing to take risks for themselves in order to support and advocate for their patients.
You see it as an extension of the work you do every day.
Absolutely.
Just one last question. Do you think doctors becoming more involved in politics could make meaningful change in these areas that you're concerned about in a way that maybe people from other professions are unable to do?
I think seeing doctors involved in advocating for these issues is important because we have a unique lens. We have a opportunity through our work to see people's experiences of grief and loss and suffering at a very close and personal level. And I think because of that, we have a responsibility to speak out about what we see and to try to change the systems that create so much grief and so much loss and so much trauma. I also think that one of our goals is to advocate for the people who are most affected by this. And I want to underscore that there have been people who have been working for decades, people who are part of these affected communities who have been doing amazing organizing and work for many, many years around these issues. And so we can't do the advocating that we're doing without the work that they've done. So going forward, we want to do whatever we can to support that important work that's being done. And if bringing our lens, bringing our experiences and what we've witnessed can do that, then we're very glad to be able to support that work.
Marie DeLuca is an emergency medicine doctor and an organizer with Doctors for Camp Closure. Marie, thanks for your time and thanks for your hard work on the front lines.
Thank you.
We reached out to ICE, and although they told us they can't comment on pending litigation, they pointed us to their website, saying ICE reviews CDC guidance daily and continues to update protocols to remain consistent with CDC guidance. In a statement, CoreCivic said they have responded to this unprecedented situation appropriately, thoroughly, and with care for the safety and well-being of those entrusted to us and our communities. You can find the entirety of their statements online at thetakeaway.org. All right, folks, that's it for your Tuesday Takeaway. It's been great having you with us. If you want to reach us, you know the number, 877-8-MY-TAKE. The show is on Twitter at The Takeaway, and I'm there as well at MattKatz00. That's K-A-T-Z. Head on over to thetakeaway.org. Also, all the segments are there, usually some extra material as well, all good stuff. We'll see you back here tomorrow. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.